Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program was brought to you by Union Beer Distributors. For more information, visit unionbeerdist.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, 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 welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43, the Good Beer Seal, and today is October 26, 2017. We've got a special live Cider Week show, some great guests. I mean, so much is going on for Cider Week New York. Last night we were at the Hidden Stars event at Astor Center with so many great New York State producers and experts, and you know, we're going to have a great show today. We're talking about kind of New York apples, these great kind of grower orchardists who are making great ciders in New York State. And joining me, you guys, everyone just go around the room and introduce yourselves.
I'm Jen Smith. I'm the executive director of the New York Cider Association.
All right.
I'm Ezra Sherman, and I'm involved with my wife and I and our partner own Eve Cidery.
Way up in...
That's a long story we were talking about. We're about 20 miles south of Ithaca, south of Seneca and Cuga Lakes. It feels like, I often describe it as like District 12 from the Hunger Games. It's the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains where Katniss is from. And it's beautiful. We really love it. And I'll try to communicate how much we like
you
it.
You practice shooting arrows at apples.
No. Boy, that's a good one.
You could, you know, Katniss, hey. And Dan, our buddy, good to have you back on the show.
Thanks. Dan Wilson from Slyborough Cider House in the northern Hudson Valley, southern Champlain Valley.
All right. Big shout out to our sponsor, Union Beer Distributors, supplier of world-class ales and ciders. So just as these guys are introducing themselves, I think one thing we're going to talk about is just how do you, you know, talk about your terroir and the region that you guys are in and what you guys have done, you know, with your orchards and the great, you know, apples that are growing in New York State. So let's just jump in. Dan, you know, you've been around a while, and tell us a little about your orchard and the region that you're in and, you know, type of ciders you're making.
The farm that I run is Hicks Orchard, and it's up in Granville. We're the oldest pick-your-own orchard in the state, and we have some orchards that are over 100 years old. But anymore, we're planting, high-density orchards mostly, and a lot of it we're segregating to either fresh market or hard cider production. So we're trying to build up our range of palette of apples that are available for our hard ciders. And kind of filling a gap because frankly there's not enough of that in the area, but at the same time New York State I think is perfectly positioned to be able to grow this great diverse range of apples and to create some great ciders around them.
Great, Ezra. So you're not quite finger
exactly?
Legs. Well, like kind of, you know, a little bit of your terroir, your orchards,
region
great. You're in, and why it's so hard to actually pinpoint. You know, do you have a region that you can say, I'm in this region for cider making?
So our terroir, I think, is largely defined by the growing practices that we bring to the orchards. We've got like three sites. One of them is extremely hilly, and then we've got a valley site, and then we've got a partner who's in between us and Ithaca, also with a kind of a sloping site and more deeply well-drained soils. For the past 8 years, we've been growing organically and moving from growing for fresh eating to only cider production, which is really, I think, it's freed us up in a lot of ways. And we've been kind of evolving in our knowledge and understanding of organic methods. I could talk about that more, and I find that very interesting.
No, and we'll get there. And yeah. Jen, so you now, as you're head of the New York Cider Association, you know, there's different cider weeks around the state. Tell us about those and kind of the regions that you guys have picked.
Yeah. Can I jump in and build on something Ezra said, though? I think it's worth noting for your listeners, some of them may already know, but the distinction between the fresh fruit that Dan and Ezra are talking about and the hard cider fruit is, you know, characteristics and qualities of the fruit that you perceive with your eye, with your palate, with your nose. So fresh fruit is really going to be about cosmetic appeal and crunch and sweet. And the cider fruit is going to be a little more expressive in terms of aromatics. It might have some tannins, might have really unpleasantly high acid in terms of, you know, trying to eat it out of hand. So it's a very different kind of fruit than what you know if you're somebody who goes to UPIC and, you know, and gets some Macintosh off the tree.
If I may jump in, I think what I usually try to compare cider to is grape wine when I'm talking to people. And to communicate what Jen was communicating, that the varieties and the way you grow it, exactly like grape wine, is reflected in the quality of the cider. And as I listen to myself, I think about something Autumn just told me before I went on the show, which is, when you talk on the radio, could you add inflection to your voice? So, okay. So I'm going to try to go up an octave sometimes.
On the radio.
Turn it into a question?
Yeah, turn it into a question.
Let Dan jump in on this
one. Yeah, sorry.
I just everyone's moving around. But Jen, do you want to just fill in? Like, sorry. So the regions, you were trying to do an intro.
Yeah, we have a couple of different cider-making regions in the state. We have a great density of cider makers in the Hudson Valley. We've got a good group in the Finger Lakes, and there's an emerging region in western New York, sort of outside Buffalo through to Rochester and Wayne County. There are also cideries in several other locations in the state. We have a couple in New York City. We have a couple out on Long Island. But Hudson Valley, Finger Lakes, and western New York are the primary regions. And we have had cider weeks in the Hudson Valley and the Finger Lakes for a few years now. And in 2018, we're going to launch Cider Week Western New York. So your listeners in Buffalo and Rochester can look forward to, you know, great opportunities to meet with makers and sample the diversity and quality of New York.
That's great.
Ciders.
It's definitely one thing that when I look at your site, the New York Cider Association, I'm seeing the Oaks family, which is steampunked. Mm-hmm. They're out by Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you've got Embark, which is Rochester. So just looking at this, you know, range of statewide, you know, producers. And those are all like great kind of apple growing regions too, aren't they?
History. And you know, there are, in New York State, there are three major apple growing regions. There's Western New York, which historically has been kind of the center of processing apple production. And this is a different kind of orchard, a different kind of set of priorities, and frankly, different varieties than you see in the Hudson Valley, which historically has been, you know, mostly about dessert apples for the fresh market. And then Northern New York, which has tried to, you know, do a little bit of both, but anymore, you know, just the nature of the growth of the apple industry, people are more focused on getting a higher return. So a lot of the guidance we've gotten from Cornell is really how to design orchards to maximize, you know, the cosmetic quality of fruit and focused on varieties that really are getting the major, you know, maximum dollar per the best return for growers, which are, you know, the high-end dessert quality fruit. So it's a complete mind shift to be able to grow apples for hard cider. And in terms of, you know, even not just the varieties we choose, but how we design the orchards, how we manage those orchards for, you know, the high flavor quality that we want to get in the ciders. So part of the work that we're trying to do is really to talk to growers to kind of convince them that there really is a market for this fruit. And I think to back up, I think we need to talk about why that's important. That for the cider industry to continue to grow, we need to kind of elevate the quality of ciders to have them really reflective of the quality of the juice and the apples that go into them, and to kind of express the range of what's possible in ciders, so that it continues to develop some connoisseurship for cider, and the market can start to mature, and then that become reflective in the value of the fruit that goes into it, and justifying the cost that establish these orchards, and that becomes a healthy industry.
You know, last night at the Hidden Stars event at Astor Center, did you have any consumers that came up to you and ask about a certain bottling that you've made, like, as if they're it's a collectible or a cult status, or people are still just trying out what you're doing? I'm going to mention Eve. That's what the other night we had a show with Steve Salen talking about still cider, and the one cider that everyone kept referencing as being like this great fruit expression was your still cider, which I don't even know the name of.
I think that's the Albee Hill.
Yeah,
and we started making a still cider several years ago. We put a lot of effort into the bubbly ciders that we make, and it is the majority of the volume that we produce, because we make all our bubbly ciders with the champagne method. But really, the still cider is, to me and to Autumn, I think the epitome of what cider can be. And that's what we kind of seek with the Albee Hill, which is a still cider. Because it's dry, so it doesn't have the sugar to camouflage the flaws or the assets of the apples that we use. And it doesn't have bubbles, which also adds a real celebratory air to cider. It's what people expect, but it's also in the same way can mask or camouflage the qualities of the cider. And if that answers the question.
So we do two still dry ciders too, and they're focused mostly on heritage American varieties, plus English bittersweet or bitter sharp. One is a 85% Kingston Black. And the reason we started to do that was because we wanted, again, I think cider makers were trying to lead people with a little bit of education on what cider is. And so for us, it was important to have people understand that this is a winemaking process. And by putting out a still dry cider, it seemed to us a smaller step to bring wine drinkers into the world of cider, because there's a continuum of ways you can describe cider. The vocabulary is very similar, and so to kind of wrap your minds around, or a customer's mind around, what we're trying to do, it seemed to be a good entry point for the conversation. And as Ezra was saying, a still cider that really is reflective of the fruit, you don't have anything to mask that basic quality of the fruit. So we don't sell a lot of it, so it's good for an educational tool. But I think there's a value in that too. And it does stimulate the imagination. But it's a very drinkable cider. It fits in a lot of occasions.
Yeah, with Ezra, we're going to taste side by side two of your ciders, different vintages.
Right. You started off the conversation talking about terroir, and I had a foreshadowing that might be on the table. So I brought two ciders that are made from Northern Spy apples, which we could talk about the origin of which. But so they're the same apple. They're different vintages. One's a 2014, one's a 2015. And they're from 100% estate grown, 2015. And then the 2014 is from apples that we bought in from a grower in Western New York. So their climate is much more moderated by the lakes, the Great Lake, whatever Great Lake he's on. My geography is poor. But
how many are there? Five.
Yeah. How many are adjacent to New York State? That's the question.
You're the first person to ever mention Hunger Games on the show. Do you know that, Ezra?
Is that true? Well, that's because I'm from Venetian. You haven't had many people from Venetian on the show. So I'm going to open it, but there is an obvious difference between the two. Once again, same apple, same production method. That is, we made both of the ciders in different years. But grown in two different sites. So,
whoa. You know, we're going to take a short break soon, but Ezra, you know, give us more backstory. So I read that in 1999, Autumn was reading about a fruit magazine and read about this guy, Steve Wood, who was had gone to England and got Scion Wood.
Yeah, you know, gladly. Autumn was 21 then, and she was working as a waitress, but wanted to be a farmer. And, yeah, she read about, and she was working with our present partner, James Cummins, at a UPIC, and was intrigued, there's a better word for it, but was intrigued by the idea of making cider, and had started making cider from drops of dessert fruit at the time. And so she read an article about this guy, Steve Wood, and that there was this thing he was talking about, English bittersweets, which are these varieties that have been discovered to have tannins, which is an asset to cider, gives it structure, etc. And she drove up and to Farnham Hill, Poverty Lane Orchards in New Hampshire, in Lebanon, New Hampshire. And Steve Wood, this was 16 or 17 years ago, and she, once again, she was a 21-year-old, you know, young person. He didn't know her at all. And he, like, totally, like, graciously received her. I'm sure he was completely overwhelmed, like everybody is who has an orchard. But took her around his orchard and collected signwood from different cider varieties and gave it to her. And really, she'll never forget that generosity at the time. And we've have a close relationship. Think they're great.
That's great. We'll come back, talk more about, you know, how you guys got started, and back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
In 1996, Sheehan Family Companies, formerly L. Knife & Son, acquired Union Beer Distributors, which was originally located on Union Avenue in Brooklyn. Union Beer has since expanded to its present location alongside the English Kills Canal in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. It has grown dramatically in the last decade as the primary distributor of Anheuser-Busch products for Brooklyn and parts of Queens through the hiring and development of the best people in the industry. In 2003, Union Beer acquired a powerful catalog of specialty brands, which immediately positioned them as the craft beer supplier to accounts in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, Staten Island, and Long Island. Union perpetually tweaks their portfolio to maintain the highest level of stylistic breadth with the most coveted brands available. Through the highest possible level of service, outstanding salesmanship of the ultimate lineup of brands, and a paramount focus on education at all levels, Union Beer has solidified its position as the only source for the best selection of beers in the seven counties of southeastern New York. For more information, visit unionbeerdist.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, it's Cider Week NYC. New York City, we're doing a special live show, and a special message from Jen Smith, New York Cider Association.
I just wanted to observe, you know, consumers often struggle to understand where cider fits between fine wine and craft beer, and of course there are three unique beverages, but one thing that is special about cider, and especially cider from the Northeast, you know, these fruits, and I think, is this what we're going to taste is Newtown Pippin, right?
This one's the Northern Spy.
But it's Northern Spy,
yeah.
Excuse me.
This also originated in New York State.
Right, exactly. So the point that I was going to make was, you know, we've got a few different apple varieties that are incredibly well suited to cider with their aromatic profiles and the various other sensory qualities that they have that are growing here naturally and make wonderful fermented products. You know, there's lots of interesting wine being made all over the country, but those grapes are not from there. And it can be a struggle to grow grapes that make good wine in most of the regions in the United States. We're blessed by having this natural, kind of indigenous fruit here that makes such wonderfully drinkable, wonderfully food-friendly.
So we should just keep this up and keep supporting New York State cider makers.
Get to know tannins.
All right. So Ezra, you're doing a little taste test with us. Talk us through. We have two vintages of what, Eve Cider, Northern Spy. Is there a label name for this cider?
Yeah, people say, what kind of cider is that? What's it made from? I say it's a Northern Spy. It's prominent on the label. I'm just going to pour the 2015 now.
So you said the 2014. So this is a good backstory. So you said that the 2014, you bought most of the apples from Western New York.
Right.
But by 2015, you had some of your own.
Yes. Well, 2014 was an off year for us. So we bought 100% of our, actually, I can't say that for a fact, but this is 100%. The 2014 is 100% from a grower in Western New York, like a large grower. Like for us, a 100-acre orchard is pretty mind-boggling. But in that region, it's not out of the question.
Is that an issue for you guys? You know, there's off years. I mean, apples produce the same every year, or they don't?
But that's a very good question. It's an enormous issue for us. This year, we're 100% estate grown because some of the younger trees that we plant are coming on. But probably two of the past 5 years, we've lost the crop. This year, we thought definitely it was another another horror story or tragedy for us. But basically, you can lose a crop by having a warm winter and then having an early like bud break and then a freeze which kills the bloom.
And so then that's it for the year.
That's it for the year, and then you get into this biennial kind of cycle where the trees in the following year, if they're not if they're allowed to yield, they will have the previous year formed a lot of fruit buds in response to not having fruit. The following year they'll produce a huge crop. They might overcrop, which affects the quality of the fruit and the health of the tree. And then the year after, even if you don't have a freeze event, you might not have you very well might not have a crop, if that makes sense. So this, and then it'll start to get this biennial cycling. The large growers who are conventional use hormones and spray their orchards to cause the fruit to drop and to avoid that biennial cycle. I think a lot of people don't realize what goes on with conventional farming, but that's one thing that most people don't realize. Also, that their apples could be like over a year old and in storage that they're eating.
So I think what Ezra is getting to is how challenging it is to grow apples, and it's true. I think that anymore there's no sense of, we all talk about the new normal, which is every season is going to be a little bit different or radically different. And so that is compounded by the fact that a variety like Northern Spy kind of wants to be biennial. And so there are, along with the seasonal or climatic variations that we're seeing and starting to learn about, there's a lot of adjustment. And so it was my understanding that in the year that you bought apples, it was the confluence of these events that you didn't have a lot of spies on hand, so you really had to go outside just to find some to make that line of cider. But also, I think it was in talking with Autumn about this too, that part of the variation is you manage the fermentation the same way, but what this cider is a little reflective of is perhaps, you know, how the orchard was managed and the difference in everything from the management strategy to how early the apples might have been harvested rather than, you know, the fully ripe apples that would produce the best flavors.
Absolutely. So should we, you guys want to compare the two? There's two glasses in front of everybody. and just tell us what strikes you as being different between the two. You could look at them first, I would say, and see if
we're
there's
looking.
A, yeah.
See any difference? We're looking. Or I've been smelling a little bit.
It doesn't help that the light's kind of yellow in here, but Lefty, which is the 14?
Yes.
Has a much more pronounced, like, golden...
Well, I think you might have got him switched.
You know, as we do this, Dan, earlier we were talking about, like, you know, the Cider Association nationwide is figuring out, like, you know, here. Tests and education for the consumer and for servers. You know, what are some, you know, contemporary language for cabaret that we can use when we're tasting? Like, the other day I was tasting and someone said there's a green... You know, a green taste to a cider. Are there any vocabulary words that
you know? I don't think we want to throw anything out. I personally, because I if it's a bit of language that is a little arcane, I think that what we want to do is to be as expressive as we can in describing these ciders and have people kind of reach for that understanding. I think that happens a lot in the wine world too. That you taste something, somebody says, "Do you taste the pepper in this wine?" And then you kind of do. So I don't really think we need a new language. I think we could probably work on being a little bit more accurate in how we describe things. But we really want to be evocative. We want people to have a sense that there is, a wide range of possibilities in how you understand cider. The apple genome is so great that you can really get some really unusual qualities in cider. And you get some really creative cider makers who are really focused on finding these things, sometimes even feral apples that come from a particular park somewhere in a little town. And consistently making cider from those trees, then that tells another story. But it should be, you know, again, about the apples that go into it.
So with regards to the comparison, I'll just lead you a little bit and suggest that so the 2014 is much lighter than the 2015. The 2015 is more golden. I think the stats on the two, the 2015 has more acidity, and it in your mouth has more tannin.
Yeah, that pops out right away. Yeah,
right.
And in the nose too, that comes across.
So same apple, same in the cider techniques, but as Dan said, you can your imagination, or you know, if you talk to the other grower, perhaps could determine the differences. Early picking is certainly a possibility before it's ripe. Climate, that the climate's moderated by the large body of water near his orchard, very near his orchard, and that type of thing. Yeah, totally.
So it's more terroir, the site, but it's also practices of
yeah,
the
totally growing. Growing methods. You know, most people, I think, when they go by a vineyard, they're used to seeing Roundup strips, you know, right underneath the grape vine rows, and it's similar with large growers, and you know what effect does that have on the quality of the fruit that the apples produce that are, you know, grown on Roundup strips as compared to a grassy base.
What's Roundup?
Roundup is an herbicide that's I don't know. I heard a story on it, but there's something like 100 million gallons of it or something.
It's like a Monsanto. It's a Monsanto product.
Yeah,
it's why we resist GMOs. It's the most common herbicide.
Yeah, and you know when I had always been told it's completely harmless. Now, lo and behold, it's coming out that it has human health impacts. But it is an amazing product because it eliminates plants, basically. Yeah. And it's so easy to use, and for a lot of people it's very important to eliminate competition at the base of the trees, but there's other things you can do which are labor intensive and expensive,
so talking about, you know, conventional versus organic. You know, how do consumers know that you're doing certain practices that these bigger guys aren't?
I would say organic certification is one place, but I don't even trust, you know, national certification right now. I think more importantly is to know your farmer, and I think that's more important than organic certification, for example, to find out from them what their growing practices are. Just for example, organic apples, that sounds like a good litmus test. Does it have an organic sticker on it? But up until maybe last year, on the West Coast, fire blight is a huge fungal disease pressure that was huge on the West Coast, and it's come here, unfortunately, and is big here now. But organic apples up until about last year could be sprayed with antibiotics, and nobody would ever guess that. But that was allowed by the USDA, U.S. organic standards. So, beyond organic, I think it's also important to consider the impact on the environment that transporting apples all over the place has on the environment. And so I think people need to know where their apples are coming from, and I think a lot of people have a desire to have that connection to the grower.
So I should be buying local cider from Ugly Fruit. And if the fruit's too pure, then it's probably got some chemicals on it.
Totally.
And Dan, what about for you guys, like statewide, or you sit on some of the U.S. Cider Association, you know, panels, and you know, what is the conversation about this, about labeling, about how to communicate to consumers, you know, that growers are doing the right thing?
Well, I think from the U.S. Cider Association perspective, the priority is. It does go to quality, but I think one of the main projects we're working on now is actually a slightly different topic, and that is creating a dryness scale so that people who are looking at a bottle of cider can have a good sense of what they will experience when they open up the bottle. And nicely, I think that's a project that the USACM is adopting from the work that we're doing here in New York State. Working with Cornell to develop the scale, which will end up being like a little bar graph on a bottle. And it won't just tell you how much sugar is in the bottle. It will kind of be a little bit more sophisticated measure of the perceived dryness of a cider, which is a combination of the acid, which is naturally in the fruit, and the sugar, which is naturally or added to the cider. But also the tannin quality, so that, you know, a very acidic cider that has a lot of sugar in it will still taste a little bit on the dry side. It's all about the perception that people have when they open up the bottle, because I think the market is gravitating toward drier ciders, which I think is a good thing, because again, I think that's a little bit more accurately reflective of what's in the bottle, and I think it shows a little bit more sophistication in the market to get past kind of entry level ciders to something that's a little bit more unique. Beyond that, we're trying to work on just the basic parameters of the framework of or an outline of how to talk about cider. As all these little projects, including comparing year to year or different regions, I think it was very early days in the cider industry. I can imagine a place, you know, somewhere down the road where we are we're so knowledgeable about the fruit that can grow, that can go into cider, that we can. That it'll be more common understanding that a northern spire that's grown in the Finger Lakes is going to taste different than a northern spire that's grown in my area in the Champlain Valley, because there's enough historical record, there's enough experience with that, and there's enough understanding and education in the marketplace that will have achieved something that's been kind of common in the wine world for a long time. We're obviously very early in the process of getting to that point. And I think that's why this experiment is so exciting, because you can really start to see that there is some real distinct difference in flavor from year to year and from region to region. And so this is like a small step in that direction.
I think I'm going to have another refill of the Eve Cider Northern Spy 2015. We're taking a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Yeah.
Like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, it's a special Cider Week New York City episode, and we're talking about reading the Game of Thrones books now. Because yeah. People upstate read books. I like that.
Yeah, we do, actually. We were talking about terroir, but...
we're getting too loose. We're getting cider drunk. Yeah, that's another concept. Terroir.
Jen was talking about the uniqueness and the... and what makes New York State special, I think, in the beginning. And it was just occurred to me while I was listening to the conversation, another thing that makes New York special is, of course, I've never lived anywhere else but New York State, so I can't say that this is a fair comparison, I guess, but we were involved in the fracking issue and anti-fracking activism. And I kind of witnessed this difference between New York State and Pennsylvania in how the public reacted to the issue and the kind of the level of organization. I won't go into that, but with regards to apple growing, it occurs to me that that there's a curiosity with growers in New York and an interest in going outside the envelope. And we've seen that in this kind of group that we have in the Finger Lakes area who talk about kind of alternative growing methods. So it's like you've got the research coming out of the universities, which can be, I think, stayed. or lack kind of inspiration or creativity. And then you've got growers who have like enough experience that they kind of have almost like an intuition in how to deal with a pest or an obstacle. And I was just thinking to myself specifically about Plum curculio, which is a very difficult insect pest for everybody. And this researcher from Cornell University, who was doing research on beneficial nematodes, they were growing them or reproducing them at Cornell to deal with a pest that infects like grain crops, but the insect is very similar. I think in its structure that it uses to inject the egg into the plant, and he suggested that the nematodes could be used to go after Plum curculio when they were in the like larval stage in the ground. So we ended up how would you say it, reproducing the nematodes ourselves, which was an interesting project. Basically, the nematodes are like a microscopic roundworm, and when we did it, we bought the nematodes. We bought these like mealyworms. They look basically like grubs that you would get in like a container of wood shavings, and those grubs had been inoculated with these nematodes, and the life cycle of the nematodes would begin by going into these grubs and reproducing and then killing the grub in the process and then emerging. So we got these containers of inoculated grubs that were basically not long for this world. And then after a certain time that they told us to wait at a certain temperature, they emerged from the bodies of these grubs. And we basically washed the nematodes off, you know, with a colander or whatever, the screen, into another container, and meanwhile had received 50 containers of these grubs for our own use, that we then like inoculated ourselves with this diluted solution of nematodes so that...
I'm waiting for the recipe. Bread them and fry them.
So your cider's not vegan.
It's almost macabre because you're basically
bread them and fry.
So the kind of the grubs are mixed into these wood shavings in each container, and we would just pour a little bit of this diluted nematode solution into each container, and 20 days later, whatever the period was, all the grubs were on the surface of the wood shavings in each container. They move to try to escape. Oh. Yeah, exactly, to escape the nematodes, but nevertheless were infected and dead. Then we washed off all of those grubs into and then diluted them and put them in the sprayer and sprayed them on the orchard floor to inoculate the orchard in the hopes that it like most things, it went a little awry, and that Autumn told me the rate to put them down on. We kind of rigged up a boom off the sprayer and made kind of our own sprayer to spray down towards the ground. And she told me the rate, which was basically what speed to go in the tractor at what RPM. And when I was like halfway through, I had run through the whole tank of these nematodes. It turns out that she had calibrated it based on the hose being kinked, and I had looked at it and unkinked it, and that kind of threw the. But we did half the orchard.
So Ezra, have you guys sold the movie rights to the story yet?
Yeah, well, I didn't embellish it at all. It was as dramatic as that.
But what this brings me to is just how much work you guys actually do in the orchard.
Yeah.
And which you're getting me to realize that just how hard you have to work to make good apples.
Yeah, and that's not even talking about like the fuel injection pump that goes at the wrong time and trying to learn how to take off a fuel injection pump on a tractor for the first time under pressure and all that stuff. But that is that's the part of like cider making that I really enjoy, which is working outside and also with tools and coming up with alternative ways of doing things.
And let's just go back. So you mentioned 1999, Autumn read about Steve Wood, went and got some Scion wood from him. You know, bring us into the 2000s. You know, tell us how you guys really got started.
Her partner at the time, she got started with James Cummins, who had a UPEC outside of Ithaca. And he's kind of a larger-than-life kind of person. He's older than – I'm 50, it turns out. I'll say that on the air. Just turned 50. But he's a little older than us, and he's larger than life. You know, he believes in crazy things. But
he's also associated with one of the bigger and more diverse nurseries in New York State.
Right. And so his family, he's like a sixth generation orchardist. His dad was a Cornell plant breeder who came up with the Geneva line of rootstocks, which is one of the three basically that are grown in this country. And his brother and his father's amazing, he's like 93 or something now, still doing plant breeding, but anyways, have a Cummins nursery, and they ship thousands, like tens of thousands of fruit trees, mostly apples, and a large portion of that being cider varieties throughout the country. But anyway, so Autumn started out with James, but he suffered a traumatic brain injury, and that was a very hard period of time. They had to leave where they had been producing the fruit, jump forward to get the Reader's Digest story version of the story to now, and now we're in Vinatin, which is about 20 miles from 15 miles from where the orchard had been, and we're planting cider-specific varieties. James still has an orchard in Newfield where we used to really rely on that production, but now we're producing much more in Vinatin, and our cidery is in an old funny story about that. But anyways, it's an old dairy barn, basically, that we've modified the inside of which to it looks like a winery inside. Outside, it looks just like a 50s era dairy barn. So there's the three of us mostly, and then there Celia Bacatus works for us, and she's like integral.
Wow,
to her.
So you guys spend time with the orchards, with trees, with pests,
right?
Land issues,
right?
It's challenging. It's amazing you got this 2015 into a bottle.
Totally. It is challenging. Thank you for acknowledging that.
Can I make a plug for people to visit the wonderful cidery tasting rooms and orchards that we have in New York State?
Yeah.
You know, it's a great way to get to know, as you say, your apple farmers and the people that are making your
cider.
How can
I find out more about them?
Well,
funny you should ask.
You know, year-round, the New York Cider Association website, which is newyorkciderassociation.com, has a map that includes the locations of all of our members that welcome visitation, welcome people to come and check out their orchards and their tasting rooms. Obviously, during the Cider Week festivals, we have a much more robust activity on our Cider Week NYC or HV or FLX websites. But year-round, you'll get the latest news if you sign up for our email newsletter. And you can do that on any of the sites, but why don't you go to ciderweeknyc.com to do it so you can see what events are coming up for the balance of Cider Week, which runs through Sunday the 29th.
Saturday.
And Saturday,
Jimmy's Cider Feast.
Jimmy's
Brooklyn
Cider
Kitchen.
Feast
Jimmy's
is going to bring
.com.
Lots of your New York favorites, as
brands.
Well as cider makers from around the world.
Basque, France.
Yep.
You know, there's other
yep.
traditions, too.
Some,
we
some West
them.
Coast homies are going to be there,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Oregon, Easy
Orchards.
Easy's
going to be there, yeah.
Yeah. But on that note, you know, New York State, cheers to you guys. It is so nice to drink this world-class and very crushable Eve Cider Northern Spy 2015, and we learned a little about just how much work it took to get into this bottle. And you know, how many cases of this did you make? Approximately,
probably 350.
300.
Yeah, 350 cases.
So we'll probably drink one case this week.
Nah.
And for you, Dan, just last jump in. I know you're involved with different cider associations, but for you again, as an orchardist. You know, anything else you want to wrap up?
Ezra's story has resonated with me. It's certainly a challenging thing to do to grow apples, and every year is a little bit different. The thing that's so cool about doing cider is that it's such a creative process. On top of the challenges of growing, it is it's really trying to discover something about this fruit in the process of making this great product, and then how to share it with people, how to it links with cuisine and fresh food and the work that we're trying to do to kind of build some culture around that. And it's really very exciting. And Jimmy, thanks for all your work on that too. It's just been.
I'm just happy to host you guys. Drink the good stuff. Thank you.
I think you've done a great job to promote cider and to bring us aboard here on the radio show, too. It's been
well, cheers
great.
To you guys.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks.
Ezra, lastly?
Thank you. I just was wanted to plug an event that I'm involved with. TJ Provenzano, I met when he was the buyer for Brooklyn Enology. He's a great guy. And he now is involved in two other endeavors. One is Rooftop Reds, very interesting vineyard on the top of a building in Brooklyn. But he's also involved in Mayanaki, which is a kind of a sustainable sushi house in Manhattan. And we're having a 15-course omakase. I looked out how to pronounce that.
You did good.
Did I get that? Yeah. Omakase. Meal on Saturday. So it's 15 courses, 7 ciders.
All your ciders?
6 of them, and then I nabbed a couple of bottles of Farnham Hill, and so that you can sign up for tickets. It's pricey, but I think it's going to be really cool, and it's all sustainably sourced seafood. I should say where possible. So it's Mayanaki. It's on the website.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to Mayanaki, or you could go to
Cider Week.
Cider Week, yeah. Yep.
And I'd say it's
sign up for that.
It is pricey, but it's value for money. And for an omakase, 15 courses and pairing at a quality place, it's actually kind of a bargain. So
well, it's nice seeing. So I definitely seen a lot more dinner pairings. It's nice seeing, you know, fine cider put into that position. And my, since we talked about Hunger Games, so you're coming from the District 12, and now you're in the Capital Region.
Yeah,
it's schmoozing it.
Oh. It's and I'm in a. I've never been on the radio, I don't think. Now I'm in a. It's so freaking Brooklyn. I'm in a radio studio. In Roberta's pizza, looking through this big plate glass window into what looks like an equipment shed, but is actually where diners are eating. You know, it's just
well. That's just why wild. You know our city folk would love to come up to your tasting rooms yeah. because you guys have the Brooklyn aesthetic already. You know,
yeah, that's right.
Barns and that's you know right. stuff. They, yeah. And Jen, thanks for coming on, guys. So Jen and Dan and Ezra, thanks for joining me on the Heritage Radio Network. This is a special Cider Week show, and our good buddy Eric West, the cider guide, he sends out an email. So hopefully he's putting these links up because he's the big supporter of cider, as everybody knows. Big shout out Justin Kennedy, our producer, and our engineer extraordinaire David Tadashore. Thanks for this special episode. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo!
Woo!
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.